Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Welcome back. I have to relate something that happened over the weekend. Rarely have I heard my wife go on about a book the way she did this past weekend over The Goldfinch. The Goldfinch by Donna Tartt. This review was so enthusiastic, she was mesmerized. And it was such an enthusiastic account that I connected with Current State contributor Scott Southard, who periodically reviews books for us, and asked if it was worth considering for a review. Unbeknownst to me at the time, it was already scheduled to be on next week. So The Goldfinch by Donna Tartt, reviewed next week by Current State Scott Southard. If this book has a fraction of the appeal for you as it did for Martha Bayshore, worth a look. Later this hour, we've got Jeff Daniels checking in. He's a busy guy as usual. And why the Camaro is coming to Lansing. We know the Camaro is going to be made at Lansing Grand River next year, but we'll get a little bit more background as to why that is the case. At the top of the program, many people have been reminded in the past month that the Lansing Board of Water and Light provides electricity to more than just the capital city. Though it's owned by the city of Lansing, the Board of Water and Light has electric customers in 9 other municipalities and townships outside the Lansing city limits. Those include East Lansing and Delta Township. But the Lansing City Charter requires board members to reside in the city. This has led our next guests and others to call for greater geographical representation on the utilities board. Current State welcomes East Lansing State Representative Sam Singh back to the program. Hi, Sam.
Hello.
And Delta Township Supervisor Ken Fletcher also joins us this morning. Ken, good to see you.
Good morning. Great to be here.
Before we get into the issue of board representation, let's address the fact that the Lansing City Attorney apparently will rule that the meetings of the community review team are not subject to the State Open Meetings Act. Sam, judging by your tweet early this morning, that is a concern for you. Why should the community review team be subject to the Open Meetings Act?
Well, I think regardless of whether the city attorney of Lansing says it's there's a need for the Open Meetings Act or not, I think the individuals on the board, as well as Mike McDaniel as its chair, can make the decision to keep these meetings open. I don't think there's going to be much discussion here that is of a private nature of, you know, if this was a private companies that were sharing documents and so forth of how much profit and their decision making that might make them, you know, more uncompetitive with other companies, you might say, okay, we should keep these private. But this is a public utility. These conversations should be public. And a number of the people on the board, you know, the 3 representatives from my area, Jerry Richards, who's a former township supervisor of Meridian, Doug Jester, a former mayor of East Lansing, Bev Baden, a former East Lansing council member, they've all lived under the Open Meetings Act for all of their decisions. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to ask them that they work with their committee members and keep as many of these meetings open to the public, regardless of what the Lansing City Attorney says.
Ken Fletcher, anything to say on that score?
Well, I agree with what Sam has said. The public's looking for answers. People have lost confidence in BWL, and they really want to get to the bottom of what went wrong. And the only way to make sure that the final report is one that everybody can agree with and feel confident that a thorough review was conducted was by having this process an open, transparent process. So I would also encourage them to make sure that they follow the spirit and the intent of the Open Meetings Act, even if they're not covered by it by law.
Now, T.J. Buchholz, the spokesman for the community review team, is on the record as saying, quote, 99% of the meetings that will take place will be open to the public. Does that reassure you? I mean, how much does that potential 1% concern you, Sam?
Well, again, I think there's also an obligation by the committee to say that during that 1%, what were they looking at? Why did they have to go into a closed meeting? You know, in East Lansing, when I was mayor, anytime we went into a closed session, we had to tell the public, this is the theme of why we're going into a closed session. And then they could understand we're in some type of litigation, we have some kind of real estate transaction, this is why we're going into a closed session. So if they are going to go into a closed session, I think it should be apparent to the public, and they should give a rationale why they're going into a closed session.
Okay. We should also point out that the community review team met at 7:30 this morning, and Current State has learned that Kyle Bowman called General Michael McDaniel last night to cite time and job demands and resign from the community review team. Let's move on to the issue of board representation. First, Ken Fletcher, about how many residents in Delta Township were impacted by the outages?
Well, quite a few. The majority of our residents are covered in the BWL territory, and I would say a majority of those residents were without power for at least some time during that 7-day or 10-day period. So a lot of our customers were impacted. And I've been told that out of the BWL service territory, 37% of their customers do not live in the city of Lansing, and the largest concentration of those people are in Delta Township. So,
and we're talking thousands of customers.
Thousands.
Then if we're talking about that much of the township. Sam, what about East Lansing? Can you put that in perspective?
Sure. About 90% of the city of East Lansing is covered by Board of Water and Light. There's a smaller portion of Meridian Township, about maybe 10% of Meridian Township, that's covered by the Board of Water and Light. Obviously, majority of people had some level of outages. Obviously, in some of our areas, we had, 9-10 days of outages. So obviously, there's a significant portion of the BWL service territory that is in East Lansing and Meridian Township, and that's why I think people like Ken and other leaders have been talking about wanting to have a geographic representation on the Board of Water and Light Board of Commissioners.
Let's look at the current arrangement. When we do, we see a total of 8 board members, all unpaid, all appointed by Mayor Virge Bernero. 4 of those 8 represent each of the city of Lansing's 4 wards. The other 4 are all described as at large, but the city charter apparently requires that all 8 are residents of the city of Lansing. Ken Fletcher, what changes would you like to see to that?
Well, I think BWL has become a regional power company. It's supplying power to, as you said, 9 communities throughout our region. So we need to really turn it into a regional body by having representation from all those communities. And it's something that would be fairly simple to do. It would take a change of the Lansing City Charter, but they just need to amend that so that they can have representation from the other areas outside the city of Lansing. And I think by adding those voices to that board, you'll make it truly representative. You'll give those customers somebody that can, stand up and advocate for them when needed, and I think it'll just strengthen BWL for the long run.
But you're saying every jurisdiction that is currently served by the Board of Water, like Watertown Township, DeWitt Township, all of them should have a member on the board?
Well, I don't know if necessarily you need a member from every single area, but I think you definitely need to have the large jurisdictions that have a large number of customers in it, such as a Delta, East Lansing, a Meridian, which has a significant number of customers. They should have some type of representation on the board.
Sam Singh, what do you think?
Again, I agree. I sent a letter out to Mayor Bonero and the Lansing City Council about 10 days ago asking them to do a few things. One was to make sure that communities that were in the jurisdiction were represented on the mayor's independent committee. I also asked that they would also take a look at their charter and then open their charter up so there would be outside membership. Now, I do think that's part of the negotiations. Leaders like Ken Fletcher, Mayor Nathan Triplett, other leaders in the region who have Board of Water and Light representation need to sit down with the city of Lansing and say, based on maybe number of customers, who should have a seat on the board? How are those seats actually chosen? Are they chosen by the municipality and then automatically put onto that board? So I think those are numbers of the local conversations that have to happen. But I think if you want a Board of Water and Light that is really regional in purpose and regains the trust that it has lost over the last month and a half, I think you have to do something of this nature.
Do you think the city administration is, how open to this conversation do you think the Lansing City Administration, Mayor Virge Bernero, are to this conversation, Ken?
Well, they're definitely open to the idea of having some type of representation and some type of voice. What form that takes is part of the discussion that needs to go forward. I would advocate that they have a full voting right on the BWL board. Others have talked in terms of having some type of citizens advisory panel that could, advise the commission. So those are part of the discussions going forward, but I'm going to certainly advocate that it be full voting representation.
Now, Sam, would you expect the community review team to make this issue a part of their deliberations or final recommendations, let's say?
Well, I wouldn't be surprised if they actually have this as one of its recommendations. I already know from talking to Board of Water and Light commissioners themselves, there's an openness by the commissioners to actually have the city take a look at their charter and kind of open it up to other communities. And so I wouldn't be surprised to see this independent committee also make that same type of recommendation. But I do want to go back. You know, for many years now, the city of Lansing has asked the county, especially in Ingham, and other jurisdictions to kind of help become more regional. So we've done this with Parter Park Zoo. The 911 dispatch that we decided to regionalize for the city of Lansing and the other communities for Ingham County now 911 dispatch actually helped save a lot of money for the city of Lansing. And so there's been a lot of requests for these outside communities to help regionalize a number of assets for the city of Lansing. So it's in the same spirit that I think many of these communities are asking the city of Lansing to help regionalize the Board of Water and Light.
Sam, are you as confident as Ken Fletcher seems to be that the city of Lansing is as open to this expanding geographical representation on the board as he thinks?
Well, again, there were positive comments so far in the news media. My brief conversations with the mayor and a few of the council members show an openness. But again, in the end, is going to be what is the details of the arrangement, and those conversations haven't happened. Again, those are not conversations that I should necessarily be involved in. Those are things that, you know, Delta Township, City of East Lansing, Meridian Township have to be negotiating with the City of Lansing and with the Board of Water and Light. But my anticipation is that that openness at least allows for this opportunity. Opportunity for broad geographic voting rights on the Board of Water and Light.
I just sit here and wonder how territorial this could become. I mean, the status quo limits all of the board members to residency in the city of Lansing. This would be a significant change.
And you would have to ask the people of Lansing to vote on that as well, you know. And I think there can be a convincing case made to the citizens of Lansing why this needs to happen. They have to approve the charter amendment in the end. But I do think if you ask the general public to embrace something like this, they will.
And this is clearly just a case where you are just adding representation to everybody who's being serviced. The city of Lansing would not be losing anything. The residents of Lansing would not be losing anything by adding that representation. It's just really having the board recognize the fact that over time, BWL has become a regional power company. It's not just a city of Lansing company that serves only the city any longer. It's one that serves the whole region. So let's have the board reflect that.
Well, there's also dollars, a lot of dollars that are involved in this equation. According to the independent auditor's report, the Board of Water and Light paid the city of Lansing at least $16 million last year and $12 million in 2012. What do you make of that arrangement, Ken?
Well, I have concerns about it because, you know, right after the storm was over with, Peter Lark, you know, announced that they would have to go for a rate increase. For a large part of that would go towards paying for that money that's going to the city of Lansing. And I know the residents who live in Delta who, you know, get service through BWL said, hold it. Why am I being asked to pay for that money that's going to help support the Lansing budget, especially when in Delta we have a power plant too? You know, they have the Erickson power plant located in Delta that we have to supply with police and fire protection. We have to supply, you know, roads and maintain them to the plant. So we have to provide all the same government services that Lansing's being reimbursed by BWL for their plants and facilities that are in the city. Well, we're saying if you're going to come and ask for a rate increase to reimburse BWL for that money that they're being asked to give to the city, well, then they need to look at, we need to have a payment in lieu of taxes in Delta to provide for those services as well, or just get BWL out of the business of sending money over to communities. You know, they're there to supply affordable power, you know, reliable power at an affordable cost. That's their mission. So let's have BWL focus on that as opposed to becoming something that's used to help balance the city's budget or even in some cases, you know, redevelop Rio Town. It's there to provide power. That's their first and primary, you know, purpose for existing, and we need to get back to that.
But which would you prefer? Would you prefer that Delta Township actually receive some of the funds in the same way that the city of Lansing does?
Well, I personally think that the residents should not have their rates artificially increased to have money being diverted, you know. So we were willing, and we have for a long time, not received anything from BWL. But if we're looking at, you know, more and more money is going to go to the city of Lansing, and if our residents are going to be asked to have a rate increase to pay for that, then in fairness, then we need to have a payment in lieu of taxes as well. So I'll advocate for that to make sure that my residents are getting what they deserve. But I think that at the end of the day, we'd all like to see good, reliable power and affordable cost. So I'd like to see those rates stay as low as possible. So I think that each community should fund their budgets without, you know, using BWL as the source of making that happen.
Sam?
Yeah, I just wanted to mention that, you know, as I testified at the BWL hearing that they held at East Lansing last week, I also shared this with Mike McDaniel, the chair of the Independent Review Committee. One of the things I want them to do is do a set of benchmarking. And I want them to look at all the public utilities in the state of Michigan and take a look at what those public utilities are doing in regards of payment in lieu of taxes and resources back to the communities that they've been chartered from. And then see, is that an appropriate level and amount? You know, I heard from a number of commissioners, again, in the media, that they felt that if they had some of those resources, they could have been better prepared, perhaps, for the storm, for different types of investments. And so we have to find the right balance. I probably do think it's appropriate to have some level of payment in lieu of taxes, but the question is this the right level? And then the other question that has to be answered by this independent committee, as well as the Board of Water and Light internal review, is if they had these resources at the Board of Water and Light, what would they have done with them? Could they have been actually better prepared to deal with this? Could they have had a better communication systems in place? You know, one of the things that they suggest that they, you know, failed them during this storm was their communication system. Well, could this communication system been better? Had some of those dollars not necessarily been going to solve budget problems, but actually been there to do core operations of the Board of Water and Light. And I'm hopeful that both committees, the internal review from Board of Water and Light, as well as the external review, will touch on some of those issues.
Well, what do you make of the recent new contract with the local PR firm, with Martin Wehmeyer in Lansing, between the Board of Water and Light and them?
Well, again, I definitely think, you know, communications was done very poorly. You know, I'm surprised they actually haven't let some people go within their communications department. I know they have an open position for operations. We know some of the operations failed. They'll have a new person there. I think they probably need to have a new person heading up their communications. And so to bring in an outside firm like Martin Wehmeyer actually makes a lot of sense to me, because you need some outside expertise to kind of fix the wrongs that happened with communication during the last 6 weeks.
Ken, what should happen regarding Peter Lark?
Well, I think that the internal review and the external review needs to be completed before any decisions really are made on any personnel changes. I think you need to really have that assessment on what went wrong, what was right, what needs to be changed, and then you do an honest assessment if the people there are capable of making the necessary changes, or if you need to change leadership to bring about those reforms. So I think that's a decision to come after the reviews are completed.
What are you hearing from your constituents most often, Ken?
Well, my constituents are just angry that they had such a hard time getting any response from BWL during this crisis. That not only, you know, the lack of communication coming to them, but they were upset about the inability to really even connect, to really get feedback from people, the misinformation that they were told. At one point, they were told that BWL knew of all the downlines, so they did not need to be reported. And then later, a few days later, it was they didn't know all the lines that were down and needed to know that information. And just so much misinformation just really have left them with a lack of confidence in the ability of BWL to really provide reliable power. So they are concerned every time they hear that there's bad weather coming, are we going to have another crisis like this? So they really want to have that confidence that things have been fixed. So that's why I think this review process is so important.
We want to thank our guests here, Delta Township Supervisor Ken Fletcher. Ken, thank you. State Representative Sam Singh of East Lansing, thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Current state on 90.5 WKAR. Throughout the year, MSU's Residential College in the Arts and Humanities brings in speakers and artists from around the country for their Wednesday Night Live series. This week they welcomed filmmaker Eric Prue. His films include Lemonade and Lemonade Detroit. His latest film, 365 Days, A Year in Happy Valley, re-examines the Penn State scandal and looks at how the community is coping in the aftermath. Current State's Emmanuel Berry sat down with Prue, and she joins us now. Emmanuel, tell us why he pursued such drastically different stories.
Well, he explains that they are drastically different, but at the same time and at their core, they're similar in the sense that they're about communities that are in transition. And just to note for this interview and for our listeners, this discussion about 365 days does cover the sensitive topics of the Penn State scandal. But before we talked about his latest film, Eric briefly spoke to me about Lemonade Detroit. Eric's introduction to Detroit was actually He was screening his first film, Lemonade, which looks at how people, Eric included, reinvented their careers and their lives after being let go. So while screening this to a bunch of laid-off Detroit advertisers, Eric was not really expecting a warm reception. But at the end of the film...
They clapped, first of all.
No tomatoes.
Yeah, no tomatoes. And then the discussion after the film were all these this incredible vibrancy of ideas and what they could do with their, you know, their blank slate now, and how, you know, the topic turned into to Detroit's blank slate, not just sort of individual people, but the city as a whole. And, you know, that optimism threw me a little bit. I wasn't really sure. And I thought, you know, the more I asked around and the more people I talked to in Detroit, native Detroiters, I realized there was something in the water there. Mm-hmm. You know, that there is this just incredible resiliency and the ability to, you know, you just keep knocking me down, but I'm just going to keep coming back and bigger and better and stronger. And I just thought, you know, for a couple of reasons. I mean, just the topic in and of itself, I thought deserved a film to be made about it. But also my own sort of penance for feeling the way I felt about Detroit. I mean, it was my first time in the city, and having come back, having visited there for the first time with all of these impressions of the city that were forged in me by years and years of watching the news about Detroit. Were everything that I believed about Detroit was formed by my impression in the media, that the media fed to me. The media did not feed to me any of the incredible stories of resilience and hope and reinvention there. Mm-hmm. And I just thought I needed to do something to make up for my own opinion, you know, to kind of give back, because I had felt guilty a little bit for being so easily duped.
So the short version of that film, Lemonade Detroit, has been released. What are the future plans for that film and that project?
Sure. So, you know, the short film, which right before he died, Roger Ebert actually called gobsmacking. Like, I had to throw that plug in there because, you know.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, Roger Ebert liked the film. So, but the 17-minute short film is done. For the last, you know, we finished that a couple of years ago, actually, and I have been sort of plugging away at trying to get the longer version done. We've done a bunch more filming since the film was released, and I've been trying really hard to figure out, you know, where does the funding come from? How can I get back in the city to do more filming? What are the new stories? And have accomplished a lot toward that. But the more I think about it, the more I would love to do and we are doing a series of shorts. So coming back every year or so, year to 18 months, and taking another snapshot of the city, because, you know, this was a snapshot of the city in 2011, you know, Lemonade Detroit. The next series could be, you know, lots changed. The city's filed for bankruptcy. There's a new mayor. There's already a new chapter, and it's just a couple of years later, you know. And I would love to, we're going to keep doing that for the next, you know, for the foreseeable future.
Your latest film that you're working on focuses on another city that's in a transition of sorts. It's called 365 Days, A Year in Happy Valley. What similarities do you see between this newest work and Lemonade Detroit in the sense of them being in transition in these kind of challenging moments?
You can't get more different than, you know, this rural agriculture farming town that happens to have a college in it, you know, 50,000 students. And Detroit, you know, I mean, you really, they're pretty as different as America gets, you know. The one real striking similarity to me, though, is that they both had their foundation and their identity sort of rocked. You know, in Detroit, so much of the identity in Detroit is based on the automobile industry, and we're a car town, and we make cars, and the middle class began in Detroit, you know. And when that industry goes away or is nearly decimated, the identity of the town suffered as well. I think you can say something pretty similar to State College and Happy Valley, in that so much of that town's identity was wrapped in football and Joe Paterno, and when the scandal of you know Jerry Sandusky and the pedophilia sort of became the story, the identity of, well, who are we then? At least from the outside looking in, not necessarily from the inside. I think the identity of the people in State College is pretty well grounded. But from the outside looking in, it's, you know, you're not Joe Paterno anymore. What are you? You know, and you know they're defined now. You know their internal definition, how they define themselves internally, I think is still sort of reforming. But to the outsider looking in, it's like now they're the pedophilia college. And you know, this film is, and honestly, like my penance, in Detroit, my reasons for wanting to work on this film about Penn State are the same. I mean, once you go there, you realize, okay, this isn't what the media portrayed.
Yeah, I mean, what was your initial reaction? Your partner on this film was Eric Porterfield. What was your reaction when he said, I want to make a movie about the aftermath of the Penn State scandal?
I think my exact quote was, go to hell. You know, I think I said no. I mean, really what I said was, Eric, you know, I'm not your man. I'm not your man because I am so personally jaded by this. You know, I have two small kids. I am actually an adult survivor of child abuse myself. So when I heard all this stuff happening, I was like, you know what? You got to find somebody else. You know, I can't do this with you. And he just kind of kept gently and tactfully feeding me little clips about why everything that I was hearing in, you know, in ESPN and Piers Morgan and all the others may not have been the whole truth.
You mentioned this a little bit, but outside of Happy Valley, the narrative of the Sandusky scandal seems to be, it's set, like, we don't think about it so much anymore in the sense. And we've already told the story. How is that narrative different in Happy Valley?
Well, I'd ask you. I mean, what do you think the story is? You know, the story to come out of the news and the general impression left by, you know, left in the wake of that. I mean, do you have a
I think in a general sense that there's a lot of blame on Paterno, and that a lot of people still harbor a lot of anger or feel that he's responsible in a lot of ways for this.
Well, I think that's exactly why I ended up wanting to make the film. I mean, I went into the project with those exact emotions, with those exact thoughts. But then when you realize that, you know, Joe Paterno was to this day the only person to have done anything. He reported it to his superiors. He reported it to the head of campus police. He was the only person to wave his hand to say, something's happening here, guys. And then to when you sort of piece that together he was like, he graduated 90% of his athletes, you know, and the NCAA average is only something like 67%. There was no achievement gap between his black and white athletes. You know, they all performed well. You know, he said, if you're not going to go to class, you're not going to play. You know, he had his character was something to be admired, and he said himself before he died that, you know, with the benefit of hindsight, I wish I had done more. And most, the media portrayed that as an admission of guilt, when really, if you take it at face value, it is more the only person who said, I feel like I want to take some responsibility for this. And I just looked at that as something to be admired, and not like, aha, I knew you were guilty. You know, we talked to one of his former players, and he said, you know, rather than say, aha, aha, I knew it. I knew you knew something. I knew you knew something. You are guilty. He looked at it as like, you know what, maybe that should be the example of maybe we all should have done more. Maybe we all should have had our eyes a little more open. Maybe we all should have you know, been a little bit more cautious because maybe we could have prevented some of this from happening.
You spent a year essentially in this community. How did it change in that year?
Well, there was a lot of, and there is to this day too, but when we first got there, all the emotions were so raw. You know, the media had just come in and just pounded the student body and the locals. And there's a lot of general distrust and infighting, and people are angry at the board of directors, the board of trustees. The board of trustees was sort of, you know, holed up and not taking any questions, and they're kind of protecting their own interests. And, you know, this debate between we need to move on and put this in our rearview mirror versus no, we need to get to the bottom of it, and who knew what when, and who from the board of trustees needs to be fired, and you know, what changes do we need to make around here to make it safer? I mean, there's just a lot of battle, and you know, Penn State, you know, I think to many Penn Staters, like, we, you know, this ain't broken. You know, one man fooled us all, and we don't need the culture here was just fine. You know, versus people who say, oh, you have a culture problem to allow this to happen. You know, then there's still that debate, and it was very raw. I would say in the last year to 18 months, there's been a lot of calming. I don't want to say that things are healed or better, but things are healing and getting better. And people are starting to have a much more gentle discourse. You know, I mean, people are really, you know, understanding each other a little better, and maybe it doesn't have to be, you know, this is the film, the position the film takes. Maybe it doesn't have to be, you know, you're right and I'm wrong. Maybe we can both have our opinions and we can allow for them both and just have some calming soup and talk about it.
Eric Brew is the creator of Lemonade and Lemonade Detroit. His latest project, 365 Days, A Year in Happy Valley, examines the aftermath of the Jerry Sandusky scandal at Penn State. Eric, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Actor and musician Jeff Daniels is a busy man, but not too busy to come back to entertain folks in his home state of Michigan. Daniels is doing a one-man stage show in 7 Michigan towns starting today in Traverse City. Now, WKAR's Melissa Benmark spoke with Jeff Daniels this week. Melissa, remind us how many projects Jeff Daniels has going on.
Well, these are just the ones that I know of. Last fall, he got an Emmy for his performance on HBO's The Newsroom. That just got renewed for one more season. And not long ago, he wrapped up filming the sequel to the movie Dumb and Dumber with Jim Carrey. When I talked to Daniels this week, I asked him what it was like to get back into the Dumb and Dumber frame of mind after 20 years.
Well, you're assuming there's a mind to get into. It was to go from Will McAvoy, you know, on The Newsroom, to Harry Dunn on Dumb and Dumber 2 was, you know, I've called it kind of an intellectual free fall. What was frightening was how easy it came back. Jim and I both were kind of going, well, that was easy. And I don't know if it says something about us, but it was fun to do, and it's to be that mindless and that oblivious is, there's something liberating about that.
You got to think that being around Jim Carrey, if nothing else, is going to bring out your inner child, as opposed to this, you know, the Sorkin writing being so dense.
Well, being around Jim, you just smile. He's just one of these people that, I mean, you know, he's a comedic genius. He really is. I mean, he's one of a kind. And to get next to that, you just can't help but smile and you know, dive in. You know, we call it just grabbing hands and jumping off the cliff and hoping, you know, the flapping of our forearms will keep us from, you know, going Wile E. Coyote face down on the canyon floor. And it's a wonderful comedic challenge to kind of jump into the craziness that is not only Jim, but Harry and Lloyd and the Farrelly brothers.
Right.
And you know, try to pull it off. And but yeah, to go from Sorkin's high speed, you know, dialogue and intelligence, these are smart people saying smart things on their mind, out of their mouth, is how we approach Newsroom. And then to go to Dumb and Dumber, where there's nothing on their mind whatsoever.
It must potentially be an interesting contrast, though, between where both of you guys were in your careers 20 years ago and where you are now. I mean, frankly, we see much more of you now than we see of Jim Carrey.
Well, I took the scenic route, the long, winding scenic route, where Jim, you know, when we were shooting Dumb and Dumber, the first one, he had Ace Ventura had been out, but Mask was about to come out. So literally, in the middle of Dumb and Dumber 1, Jim got Batman. And so he was, you know, a rocket heading to the stratosphere. And by the time Dumb and Dumber opened, he was Jim Carrey in capital letters. So he was off and running. And, you know, when you get that, whether it had been him or me, doesn't matter. You jump on that train and you ride it. But, yeah, I've got an off-Broadway streak in me where I do the indie world, and I just went for strong writing, and sometimes that isn't what ends up at studios. And so now you're in the indie world, and then eventually, you know, did a couple of movies here in Michigan, and was just writing plays for the Purple Rose, and I'm very happy doing that. And then when Sorkin came along, you know, years later, it was kind of this, you know, suddenly I'm, you know, not dead. Suddenly I'm, you know, still in the business to some people. So it's just kind of been an in the shadows kind of career, doing a whole bunch of things, and then now Newsroom helps, and certainly Dumb and Dumber 2 is going to, you know, make it difficult to go through airports again.
One of the striking things about the list of your credits is the contrast between the characters that you play, and when you're kicking around an offer, what do you think has to appeal to you for you to say, yeah, this is the next thing I want to do? Is there a common thread or really not?
I think that the thing that is a high priority is it unpredictable? Is what the character does unpredictable? Do you get ahead of it? Is the character just a plot device to move the story along for the 28-year-old actor who's making $10 million? You know, and if that's the case, then you pass. And you get a lot of those. But is the story unpredictable? Does it surprise? Do the smart people out there who think they know everything, do we surprise them? Do we, you know, can we stop the story on page 50 and go, tell us what happens next? And if 9 out of 10 times, either me or what you consider the smart people out there will be wrong, great. That's a good story. That means, and is it plausible? All of those, that's hard to do. That's why people complain about writing so much, is because in Hollywood it gets so formulaic,
right,
that, you know, you're ahead of it.
So unpredictability is a plus.
Because you've done it. You know, I'm entering my fifth decade almost of doing this, and you get bored.
And the stage show that you're taking around Michigan and elsewhere is, it sounds like, something completely different from Newsroom and Dumb and Dumber. And what's that about?
That's something I've been doing for, you know, I've been playing guitar since the 70s, and really not publicly until about 2001. Where at the Purple Rose Theater Company in Chelsea, we always need to raise money. And in 2001, over the Christmas, New Year's holidays, we said, what can we do to raise money? We're dark, we're between shows, people are in town, they're around. And we said, wait a minute, you play guitar? Well, yeah, on my back porch. Why don't you go out and play some of your songs? We'll charge money. So I did it, and, you know, after a couple of holiday seasons of doing it, and got over the flop sweat.
Really?
Oh, my God, yeah. You're naked. And I wasn't prepared for that, to go out there. And it's stuff you've written. You've been playing for 20 years, some of them. But there's no band. It's just me. And the stories and the patter and the jokes you have to find. And then you sing these songs, some of which are, like, you know, a little personal. And you realize that, what I came to understand was there was no character. You walk out in a movie, a play, or whatever, and you there's a character, so there's a filter. you can go there emotionally, but it's always with this mask of the character with a different name. Well, now the name is me, and it's a song I wrote, and here it is, and there's no filter. So that took some time to understand how to do it.
Well, one common criticism I've heard of actors is that sometimes people will say, well, he always plays himself. And so what's nice about this arrangement, I suppose, is that you get to play widely divergent people in your acting career, and you actually get to play yourself for these shows because, as you said, it's your material.
Yeah, and it's also me in a spotlight, me in a great mood, me glad to be here, turn on the lights, you know, I'm going to hold you for 90 minutes or whatever it is, and it's not going to feel like 90 minutes. You're going to laugh harder than you have in a long time, and then drop in the ones that are going to make you feel something. And there's an art to that. You know, the guys like, well, good God, Arlo Guthrie, Stevie Goodman, John Prine, Lyle Lovett, John Hyatt, Christine Lavin, Cheryl Wheeler, on and on and on. These people, Guy Clark, Utah Phillips, these people have been doing it for decades. And there's an art to that. And it's not just going out there and winging it. And I enjoy the challenge, the creative challenge of that, and making sure that I take them for a ride without having, you know, a 16-person band and 12 dancing girls.
That's so cool that you mentioned Utah Phillips in there.
Oh, my God. Jim Fleming's my agent, my music agent, and Utah Phillips was playing the Ark in Ann Arbor, and I'd never seen him, heard of him. You know, I knew Ani DeFranco and Utah had made a thing, CDs together and stuff. I was aware of him. Jim says, you got to see him. I said, well, okay, and went and saw him. His first song was 20 minutes long, and he kept stopping it.
Yep.
And going off and off and this and that side street and that thing and all over. And then finally it ended. And then at the break, I told Fleming, I said, that's the best piece of improv I've ever seen. He goes, no, it's all written. It's scripted. He knows exactly what he's saying, every word. And he made it look so spontaneous. Another great guy who does this, local or a Michigan guy anyway, is Joel Mavis.
Oh, yeah.
Just what a player. And a great songwriter, and another guy that can walk out there with just a guitar and hold an audience. I love that about him.
What influenced your decision to go to parts of Michigan that don't usually get big-name people? I thought that was so cool. Bay City, Fremont, you know. Why did you go to some of the smaller places?
Kathleen, my wife and I, we went on a little 10,000, literally 10,000-mile, 50-city gig tour two or three falls ago. Played all kinds of places, you know, like Ellsworth, Maine, and, you know, on and on and on. And time and time again, people will go, thanks for coming. Thanks for coming to Ellsworth. Thanks for coming to Sheboygan, Wisconsin. Thanks for coming to Duluth. Thanks for coming to Fargo.
Right.
And Alaska. We went to Alaska, and people said, thanks for coming all this way. We had a great time. So the audiences are kind of halfway there for you. You know, you're the thing that to do it in, whether it's Fremont or Traverse City or wherever it might be, Bay City, you're the thing to do that weekend. For you going to the New Yorks and the Chicagos, and good God, you're hoping to get 100 people because there's so much else to do besides watch an actor sing.
One of the things that comes up in almost everything that's written about you is how you've chosen to live as much as you can in Michigan. What do you think are the fundamental philosophical differences between Michigan life and big city life? I don't mean, you know, the obvious physical things like, you know, rent, how much it costs, and traffic. I mean, what do you think is the intangible part of living in Michigan versus someplace bigger?
I think the biggest one, I've written a song called about being on the red carpet at all these awards shows. And you really have to play the role of, are you as excited about me as I am? That's the name of the song. And there is this kind of self, you know, the importance of self, your importance to the world that exists, certainly in Hollywood. And it's part of the deal. It's part of the, you have to sell yourself and be about yourself. And we're in the Midwest, we don't think too highly of the people who trumpet themselves and sell themselves, you know, it's kind of do your job and move on, do it as well as you can, but nothing's given to you here. And I think sometimes in Hollywood in particular, you can get things without having done very much. You can find success without having really earned it. And that's death. I mean, that, you learn that in Star School, the fictitious Star School. The worst thing to do is become a star and you're not good enough. And I tell young actors all the time, I said, don't buy it. Don't buy the you're as good as everyone says you are. You need to outwork everybody on the movie or on the TV show or in the play. You need to outwork everybody else. When you do that, then maybe you've earned what some people say about you. But and that's why I kind of really like the people that are that have longevity. I was just at the SAG Awards, and it was great to talk to Meryl, to Tom Hanks, Jeremy Irons, you know, Ronnie Howard, people like that, people who've been doing it for decades, like the Utah Phillips in music. I love those people. There's it's tough to last for decades in show business, and I admire people like that.
That was actor and musician Jeff Daniels, who's currently on tour in Michigan. For Current State, I'm Melissa Benmark.
Current State's coverage of the North American International Auto Show in Detroit continues today with a look at the good news the people at the General Motors Grand River Assembly Plant in Lansing got last year. GM will move production of the Camaro to Lansing from the plant in Oshawa, Ontario. And Current State Scott Pohl joins us again with more on the next car that will be built here in Lansing. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Mark.
What'd you find out about moving the Camaro here to Lansing?
Al Oppenheiser is the chief engineer on the Chevrolet Camaro project, and he says a deciding factor was that Lansing Grand River is already set up to build rear-wheel drive cars, namely the Cadillac CTS and ATS. The Oshawa plant, where the Camaro is built right now, switches back and forth to building other models that are front-wheel drive, and that has presented some efficiency challenges.
The Camaro is the only rear-wheel drive program produced at our Oshawa assembly plant in Oshawa, Ontario, and as such, even though it's a flexible manufacturing plant, there's some inefficiencies with having one rear-wheel drive program and the rest being the front-wheel drive. That would be the XTS, the Regal, and they were producing the Equinox, and now they produce the Chevy Impala. So looking at our manufacturing landscape, the Lansing Grand River assembly plant has just been producing some outstanding Cadillacs, which are rear-wheel drive, and we made the assessment that as we go into the future with Camaro, we should be looking at opportunities to grow our supplier base, see if there's any way we can commonize parts and processes with the vehicles that are already produced there today.
Do we know more about a timetable for work to begin in Lansing?
We still have a few things to do yet with the existing Camaro that's at Oshawa. We're here at the auto show talking about the Z28, which comes out in the spring. And we've still got a few things up our sleeve with the current car before we turn our focus on the next gen. I can tell you will not be this year. Like I say, we've got the 2014 introduction of the Z28 coming here in the spring, and that will go on for quite some time yet.
What can you tell me about how the next generation of Camaro will differ from its current iteration?
I actually can't go too much into detail about that. What we're doing is we daily, our whole team, we study the competition, which is the Ford Mustang. They've also introduced a brand new car here at the auto show. We're always looking at things we can do from a performance standpoint, from a mass standpoint. So we're still trying to decide the final design where we go forward with it. The key thing for the Lansing Grand River move is we're looking for efficiencies in the Lansing area supply base that as we move the rear-wheel drive products, except for Corvette and trucks, to the Lansing Grand River Assembly Plant, that we can take advantage of economies of scale.
The rear-wheel drive is a big part of the identity of the Camaro, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's been a rear-wheel drive since it started in 1967.
You know, the Lansing Grand River plant builds two cars. It builds the Cadillac ATS, which won the North American Car of the Year award last year, the CTS, which was a finalist for the same award this year. General Motors might be hoping for a three-peat of at least nominations for Car of the Year when the Camaro is fully underway in terms of construction here in Lansing.
Well, a three-peat would imply it's next year, but I tell you, I agree with you. When the next-gen Camaro gets displayed at the North American International Auto Show, we have a lot of supportive people that hope we're in the finalist category. Could be as lucky as the Corvette team was today.
I'd like to know a little bit more about who's involved in the redesign. Are you including people from the union, workers, with regard to these ideas? When does it reach that stage where people in Lansing might be involved?
We've actually made a couple trips to the Lansing Grand River plant. We before the holidays, the current Camaro team, we took a field trip, if you will, to the Lansing Grand River plant, met the plant manager, met the head of the UAW, the locals, the local chapter. We met the quality teams. In fact, there's a tradition at the Lansing Grand River plant that the Cadillac team brought to that plant working with their UAW partners. It's called Docker Days. And Docker Days is when the engineers and the program teams get in their cars, drive to Lansing, and they actually work on the assembly line for a couple of days. And they get trained by the UAW operator, and at some point they turn it over to the engineer or the marketing person or, you know, the person from central office, and we get a chance to build cars. So I got a chance to build cradles. I got a chance to build front rear suspensions, and it was the gentleman's name was Ed that trained me. He was phenomenal as a trainer. That's his secondary job there at the plant, and it's quite a process because we took away a lot of learnings back to central office on the things that we learned from the workers at the plant, and it gives you a different perspective on how you might engineer something differently next time.
Is the styling of the Camaro part of this process? Will it be different?
We don't know that yet. We're still in the phases of thinking about what we want to do. I can tell you this, though. It will be a rear-wheel drive, and we will make sure that when it's revealed, it will clearly be identified as a Camaro. Some of the cues of a Camaro that make it such are the long dash to axle and the slanted windshield. We want to keep the DNA of that first-gen Camaro 67 to 69. We would like to keep that. So it's easily recognizable as a Camaro, yet contemporary enough to stand the test of time.
That reminds me of the approach to the redesign of the Corvette Stingray. You can easily tell that this is a Corvette. You'll still know that this is a Camaro.
Absolutely. With the Corvette being our big brother, if you will, we've got a very capable two-seater sports car. And so we're the four-seater pony car, and that's what we'll always be. And as trends change in design, in cooling the car, in performance, in fuel economy, all those things we're taking into account are going to lead us to a path to design another great Camaro.
Thank you so much for spending a little time with me today.
Well, thank you, Scott. I appreciate it.
Al Oppenheiser is chief engineer of the Chevy Camaro project. For Current State, this is Scott Pohl.
And tomorrow here on Current State, we'll have a look at some of the fun and games to be had if you visit the North American International Auto Show in Detroit this weekend. That's our show for today. Also tomorrow, we speak with a former German World War II soldier about his experience in a Michigan POW camp. Also live music tomorrow. Hope you can join us. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for listening to Current State on WKAR.